But for tonight, we're going to continue our survey of the tantric universe. So week seven, we're diving in really deep now. So what we've covered already, the bulk of the course, the unique characteristics of Tantra that are summed up in the six names of Tantra, how Buddhist Tantra is based on a foundation of the three principal aspects of the path: renunciation, bodhicitta, correct view. We've looked at the qualities from our side as a student for us to cultivate, especially the open-minded attitudes, and also developing a sense of confidence by doing research, and the qualities of a Vajra master and how important it is to check out the master first before making the commitment. We've looked at the four classes of Tantra, how it's divided into four classes according to how much blissful energy we can take onto the path without getting into trouble. And mostly the initiations that are given are the lower tantras, Action Tantra, Kriya Tantra, or High Surya Tantra. And the in-between two aren't necessarily given so much. I don't know if it's for these days, but the Action Tantra, which we looked at last week, is very good level of Tantra to get started with Tantra, because it's not complicated. You won't get into trouble. The meditations are very straightforward. It's a really beneficial, like Medicine Buddha and Chenrezig and Tara. Then the path of High Surya Tantra tonight is a whole other whole different story. We've looked at the substantial causes for Dharmakaya and Rupakaya, the mind of a Buddha and the form of a Buddha. And last week with the Path of Action Tantra, you remember there were two main approaches. Do you remember what they were? I've given you a hint with the picture. Yoga with signs and yoga without signs. And so yoga with signs, what's that about? What's it for? What's it about? What does it include? It's about calm abiding. Yes, so actually all of Action Tantra is about trying to, in particular, it's very effective for developing calm abiding, and yoga with signs for developing calm abiding, yes. And it's all the meditations to do with arising as the form of the deity, the environment, the offerings, all of the appearances, appearing while empty. And the yoga without signs, so that's the empty part, not the appearing part, but the empty part. And so the main point for that one, yeah, that's right, developing insight, meditating on emptiness. And so the yoga with signs is a substantial cause for the Rupakaya. Yoga without signs is the substantial cause for the Dharmakaya. And then we also had a quick look at how the actual meditation process goes. And the term is self-generation by means of six deities, which is a bit of a mouthful. Lots of things in Buddhism are a bit of a mouthful because they say what they mean and mean what they say. So the self-generation, you remember it was like with a microscope of drilling down to various layers of subtlety, actually starting off in the most subtle and then coming back to, up from the quantum field of probability and emptiness up through the chemicals and DNA and then the form body arising as the deity. And so those, what's called the six deities, they were the way that we meditate is a process, so we become familiar, but they're not separate. They all exist simultaneously. Just like when we're looking through a microscope, we can look through all of the various levels and they all exist simultaneously. It's really hard to focus on all the levels at the same time. So we go through a process. So for tonight, we're going to have a look at path of High Surya Tantra. So with High Surya Tantra, it's quite different in its structure to the lower tantras. How exactly do we transform ourselves into a Buddha in just one lifetime? So now we're getting down to the particulars. And for example, the lower tantras, it's like learning about nuclear power in general, whereas high yoga tantra is like getting the plans to the power station, getting the actual diagrams and knowing what's going on and being able to build it and work it yourself. Whilst we are having a look at highest yoga tantra, HYT, we're going to have a psychic anatomy lesson. I've always liked anatomy. I'm not very good at anatomy, but I find it fascinating, and a psychic anatomy lesson is really quite something. And so within the psychic anatomy lesson, we'll be looking at chakras, channels, winds, drops, the whole lot. And the path of highest yoga tantra, what it does, what distinguishes it, is taking death, intermediate state or bardo, and rebirth onto the path. So instead of yoga with signs and yoga without signs, you have this death, intermediate stage and rebirth, taking that onto the path. So what I wanted to do was for our meditation to start with, there is this image here for those of you who aren't that familiar with the 9-round breathing. We're going to do a short meditation on the 9 rounds. And within it, we can imagine these channels that run through our body. So the central channel, imagine it just in front of your spine, and it's about the thickness of your little finger, made of light. So it's like neon, but really flexible and radiant. And so it comes up inside your body in front of the spine and curves around your head like the shape of an umbrella handle. And then the opening comes out around about kind of in between the eyes and the bump of the nose. And then the two side channels go parallel to that, and they're a little bit thinner, and they go from each nostril and they curve around the inside of the skull and down on the side of the central channel. And then they join into the central channel. It's 4 finger widths below the navel. So that's kind of how they go. It gives you an idea there. So we can just do a really simple meditation, and as long as you kind of have a feel for where those channels are. Let's start by straightening our posture. If you're on a chair, then sitting well back in the chair so your lower back is supported. Having your hands in your lap so that the posture is nice and contained. And pulling the shoulders back a little bit. And imagine that central channel running through the inside of your body, and actually as if you're being pulled up from your crown by this thread of light. So your body naturally, the posture naturally becomes straight, alert, but still naturally keeping the curvature of the spine. Bring your focus inwards, just become aware of the rising and falling of the breath. Once you've straightened the body, then you can relax the body and let go of any tension from the neck and the shoulders. And surrounding you, imagine an envelope of light. And this light is all the kindness and the care in the universe manifesting as light. All the kindness and care of all the Buddhas, of all the Bodhisattvas, of all the ordinary beings. Wherever kindness and care is shown, imagine it manifesting as light that envelops you, surrounds you. And then imagine that you breathe in through the left nostril, and it's actually breathing in through the left channel. And you breathe in this blissful, radiant light, all the essence of the kindness and care And this light flows up, curving around the inside of the skull, flows down that left channel. When it gets to below the navel, you breathe out through the right channel. And as you do, that light pushes out all the negative energy, all the darkness and the confusion. As you're breathing out through the right channel, feel it all being, the darkness being pushed upwards and outwards, and you breathe it out. So do this three times, but leisurely breaths, and rather than just concentrating on the physical breath, feel that you're breathing with those channels. Breathing in all of the blissful radiance, the love and the wisdom that flows through your body, down your body. Breathing out through the right channel, pushing out all the darkness, confusion, and the disturbing emotions. So three times. And when you've done those three, swapping the nostrils over, and this time breathing in through the right nostril, the right channel, inhaling that radiance and that blissful, energized light. And it flows through that right-hand channel, down through your body, crosses over. And as you breathe out through the left channel, again, feel all the darkness of the negative energy and confusion and unhappiness. Breathe it out in the form of black smoke. It's just pushed up and outwards. So with the channel swapped over three times. Feel how those channels begin to feel cleared. And then for the final three, breathing in through both of those side channels. The light flows down through your body. And as you breathe out through the central channel, and feel that that central channel also is completely cleared of the darkness and negative energy. That you exhale that in the form of black smoke that just disappears into space. So again, three long, leisurely breaths. And when you've completed the nine rounds, then spending a few moments just simply breathing radiant, clear light. Feel those channels radiant and clear, all the blockages gone, and that radiance permeating your whole body, flowing through all of your nervous system, through your torso, your arms, your legs, your body clarified, clear, and energized. And then from this state of clarity, we can focus our motivation for tonight. That as we're investigating, doing our survey of the tantric universe, that may we have the merit, the fortune to be able to quickly complete the path to enlightenment. Not just for our own sake, but because countless sentient beings are suffering and relying upon us. And we can't wait one moment longer to help them. And this is the most effective way to be able to help them. And it is possible for us to do. So with this sense of urgency and hopefulness, with an altruistic motivation, and you can slowly bring your focus back to the room. So we went through the meditation fairly quickly, but it's a fairly simple meditation, and were you able to feel the energy go through the channels and kind of follow the energy a little bit, even for a smidgen? Yeah. No, it's not a physical thing. It's the channels. So there are many ways to do this, and in various yoga practices, there are, you know, physical ways to do this. And there is a amazing video clip of His Holiness the Dalai Lama doing this as a practice as well, where he does block the nostrils, but there are movements to do with your arms when you do it. But mostly when we do this, it's just in imagination, because we're not working on the physical breath, but the energy, which is very close to where the physical breath is. So you can feasibly do it if you've got a blocked nose. It's okay. So the reason why I wanted to start off with this particular nine-round breathing is because we're all familiar with this meditation to some degree in doing meditations here on Thursdays and Sunday mornings. And sometimes it's just very simple, just breathing in or in light and out the smoke. Then this is a little bit more specific with the actual becoming aware of the channels, clearing the channels. Yeah. Kind of through your forehead, it's called the peak of the nose, which is just kind of in between the eyebrows, a little bit lower. Okay, so the path of highest yet, Tantra, here we go. The basis of samsara and nirvana. So our body, our human body can be the basis of both samsara, cyclic existence, all of our problems, all of our suffering and the nature of suffering, but it can also be the basis of nirvana, of attaining lasting happiness, peace. So normally we view our body as being the source of all of our problems. It's attachment that keeps us bound in samsara. We keep coming back and again through the power of attachment. We have uncontrolled death, intermediate state, and rebirth. Whilst we're in this body, we keep on making more negativities. And so often, and in particular in the individual vehicle, it's seen as a real source of problems. From a tantric perspective, the body is actually the basis of nirvana, because this very physical form is the perfect vehicle to carry us to enlightenment. So this is what Lama Yeshe says from Introduction to Tantra. And remember, when we're talking about Highs Yoga Tantra, it's in particular about death, intermediate state, and rebirth. So turning these experiences into the path to enlightenment is not a fantasy. Because we have the type of body that we do, we can definitely accomplish this great aim. According to the Sutra teachings, our present physical body is viewed largely as a hindrance. It's decaying from moment to moment. It's prone to sickness, attracts misery, and in the way a magnet attracts pieces of iron. In fact, the most succinct way of defining the first noble truth of suffering is to say it's the body itself. So that's usually our point of view. But from the tantric teachings point of view, they take far from being a hindrance or an obstacle, the human body is regarded as something most precious because it contains all the necessary equipment for reaching enlightenment in one lifetime. We're fortunate to have this type of body and shouldn't waste the precious opportunity it gives us to realize our full potential. We should not be like those people who don't know how to use their natural resources properly. For example, I know of some Nepalese farmers who cut down mango trees for firewood. It takes so many years for a mango tree to grow, and its fruit is so precious. But these people don't seem to appreciate this. Instead of making good use of what they have, they destroy these precious trees, lose their land through erosion, and are left with nothing. If we neglect to use our body's precious energy for the attainment of enlightenment and squander it instead on the meaningless pursuits of this life, then we are far more ignorant than those farmers. Rather, we should be like the ingenious scientists who know how to extract energy from everything, from the sunlight, the tides, the wind, and who also know how to put this energy to constructive use. In other words, we should be skillful, and the highest skill involves transforming our present body from a source of pain and dissatisfaction into the blissful path to unsurpassed happiness for ourselves and others. This is the ultimate goal of all tantric practice. So we've got this mango tree and we don't even know it. It's like, whoa, what's that? What can we do with it? Oh, it's in the way. And, you know, it's actually the source of all these richnesses, these incredible fruits. So Geshe Tashi Sering, when he was talking about this, said, you know, whether we go up or down, it's our choice. And on the tantric vehicle, it's, to continue the metaphor, we've got our passport. The passport that means that we can travel everywhere safely. We're okay. The three principal aspects of the path. Wherever we want to go, we get the visa. That's the initiation. We have our guidebook. And tonight we're looking at the Highest Yoga Tantra guidebook. What's the vehicle? Well, it's not just an airplane. It's this actual human body. Perfect. It's like this body can be a machine for enlightenment. So let's have a look. The three levels of subtlety in the body. So we've got the coarse body. And again, these three levels of subtlety, they exist simultaneously, but we're kind of just looking at different aspects. So our coarse body, it took a while for our Western science to discover how our body worked, you know, how the circulatory system worked, the bloodstream, the vessels, the nervous system. If you've ever seen medieval drawings of how the body looks, there's a lot that was made up. You know, and it took Da Vinci and it took Descartes and it took Laura to actually do incredible research to find out about the body. And most of what was found out and recorded about the body was from dead bodies, not from live bodies. There's a whole other tradition from live bodies in our Western culture, of course, that was lost. With our coarse body, blood and bone and flesh and everything, we have the coarse consciousnesses. So there is sight, but there's the awareness. And our Western system is really good at differentiating this. I read a fantastic book on sight where you have, you know, all of the photons and whatever coming across space and they hit your eyeball and there's that machinery there. Then that information turns it, you know, because it hits upside down, doesn't it? So it turns it up the other way, sends it to the brain, turns it up the other way. Then there's another part in the brain that ascribes meaning. And if you have an acquired brain injury for any of those parts, you might see things, but there's no meaning. So people, there's one thing where you can see all the parts of someone's face, but you can't put it together. So it's as if you see an eye there and an ear there and a nose there, and you can't figure out who you're looking at because the parts don't come together. So your eyeball's working, but the part in your brain's not. So this is all part of the coarse body, and even that's got levels to it. And those coarse consciousnesses. And so most of our awareness is taken up with these coarse consciousnesses, what comes in through our eyes, our ears. There's not much thinking going on there. It's just kind of experience. And we may not even be aware very much of it. What we see and then what we actually ascertain and remember, it's like 5%, isn't it? So then we have the subtle body. And the subtle body is made up of channels, chakras, drops, and winds. The winds upon which the mind or the consciousness rides. So these are more subtle than our circulatory system or our nervous system because they're still physical. The subtle body, it is physical, but it's on a more subtle level. And so if you've had acupuncture, that works on this level. Or if you've done Tai Chi and you can feel the Chi, that's on this level. And when these are out of balance, that's when we become sick. That's when it manifests as sickness in our body. And then from a tantric point of view, we have very subtle body and mind. So it's divided into three, coarse body, subtle body, and very subtle body and mind. And this is the fundamental mind and the subtle wind upon which it rides. So very subtle, they're inextricable, you know, the movement and the awareness. So this very subtle level is latent. It only really becomes manifest at the time of death. Just like when all of our senses are drawn outwards, most of our awareness is drawn outwards, we're not very aware of what's going on, even in our nervous system. So if you've ever been a little ungrounded and discombobulated and had a day where you just bump into things, that's because all of our senses are drawn outwards and we're not aware what's going on with our balance, with our subtle body, let alone the very subtle body and mind. Yep, that's when it becomes manifest because it's the clear light mind, that clear light and the very subtle wind. So that's in a latent state at the moment. It's no. Bardo is a type of life. This is a body. This is the most subtle body and mind that we have, but it's latent. So it's in there, but it's like layers of an onion. When the top layers are prominent, you can't see what's in there. So it becomes manifest at the time of death because the coarse body, you know, the breathing stop, the heart stop, all of those coarse consciousnesses have fallen away. Then the circulatory system has stopped. Then all of the subtle body falls away. And then what's left, the clear light mind at the time of death, the subtle mind and the winds. And this is what goes from life to life. This is the continuity. None of the other stuff goes from life to life. At death time, yep, all of the winds absorb. But most of the time, our winds travel outwards. Oh, look at that. constantly out, out, out. But at death time, because everything's collapsing and disintegrating, yes, they absorb back in to the heart. The time of death, then, as the, you know, the body shuts down from the most coarse to the most subtle, then in the end, when the subtle body and mind leave this coarse body, that's what's called death. So then the body, our coarse body, becomes a corpse, and the subtle mind arises into the intermediate state in the bardo. And so what we're aiming to do in Highest Yoga Tantra is take this natural process and harness it, because the most subtle mind, the very subtle mind, is the best mind to meditate on emptiness, because there's no other distractions. It's a very powerful mind. So our aim is to gain control over this process and to be able to separate subtle body and mind from coarse body and mind. It happens naturally at death time, but the aim of Highest Yoga Tantra is to be able to do this within meditation. No, actually. So we'll get there. Hang on a sec. I've got some readings from Lama Yeshe to introduce this. According to Highest Yoga Tantra, our body and mind exist not only on the gross level we're normally familiar with, but also on subtle levels about which most of us are completely unaware. Our ordinary physical form, composed of various material elements, is subject to the inevitable sufferings of sickness, decay, and death. Merely possessing it binds us to the recurring miseries of our ordinary existence. But within the boundaries or atmosphere of this body is another far more subtle body, the so-called Vajra body. Vajra having the connotation of indestructible. Just as our gross and perishable physical body is pervaded by the ordinary nervous system, the subtle Vajra body is pervaded by thousands of channels through which flow the energy winds and drops that are the source of the bliss so vital to highest tantric practice. As is true of our essentially pure and blissful mind, this subtle conscious body exists within us right at the present moment. And the job of the tantric practitioner is to discover and make use of it. Once we've made contact with this clear conscious body of light through meditation, our gross physical body will no longer be a problem for us. Physical limitations are just another symptom of ego grasping. And once we merge with our essentially pure nature, all such restrictions will be overcome. At that point, the attainment of the radiant light body of the deity ceases to be merely a visualized goal and becomes a reality. So this is specific, not just analogies, but there is a process. So let's have a look at the subtle body, the machinery of Highest Yoga Tantra, our psychic anatomy lesson. So one thing that I discovered is that there are different ways to depict even things like chakras. One way you depict how the end point should be, so like the lotuses, you know, with the seed syllables on it, so it's like an idealized, wonderful, perfected end point. Another way to depict them is like an anatomical drawing of what's actually there, so that's the other side, which is a lot more like these kind of branches, but they're still all very symmetrical. If we were going to take a mental snapshot of what our chakras looked like, in particular chakras meaning wheel or knot, they're just tangles constricting the central channel like a tangled ball of wire. So all of the, that's why there is such a range of illustrations of chakras, because some are from the point of view of starting where we are, the practice. Others are from the point of view of the result. So they're all from different points of view. Yep, we'll get there. So just like when we're looking at atoms and particles and whatever, we need sophisticated equipment. We can't see it with the naked eye. So the same for being able to see these psychic elements, we have to have subtle equipment. And what that equipment is our focus. It's our mind. The equipment that we use is the mind. And just like when you see x-rays or those scans that they do, you know, those body scans, the MRI scans, you need to be trained how to interpret them, because they just look like mush to start with. So the same thing when you're doing this, we need to be trained how to interpret these experiences. So we need sophisticated meditation to recognize these subtle levels of existence. So to start with, we've got channels, 72 branches in the body, and this is the psychic nervous system. So those branches are depicted there on the right-hand side. They're all nicely symmetrical like that. Mostly what they're depicting is the number of channels that come out, and then they go out and then they divide, and then those ones divide and those ones divide till you get 72,000 of them, and they permeate your whole body. So the psychic nervous system runs parallel to our physical nervous system. And these channels are almost like a vehicle for consciousness, because as the energy runs along them, then that's where our consciousness is. As a tantric meditator, when you direct the winds into the central channel, out from all of these extremities and into the central channel, then what happens is all of the conceptual consciousnesses and elaborations and chatter and everything stops. Normally, while we're alive, our central channel is all blocked and constricted. When the energy runs into the central channel, then the bliss and clear light arises. So this happens both at the time of death, but also in meditation. So I'm thinking maybe we should just go on with the rest, but I'm hesitant. Should I ask questions? Yeah, go for it, Ben. Yep, and very subtle. Yeah, basis and path. Generally, when we talk about the coarse body and mind and the subtle body and mind, we just talk about the two extremes, this coarse physical body and then the subtle wind and mind. But this middle part of the psychic nervous system, that's only talked about in Tantra. This actual physical body, because it houses this psychic nervous system, can be the basis of Nirvana, this actual physical body. And when you think about it, like with the 72,000 branches and the chakras and everything, it's perfectly designed. If, for instance, you were a cow and you had 7 stomachs, your whole channels and chakras and everything would be different. They wouldn't work the same way. Or if you didn't have a stomach, or if you've got 2 stomachs, or all of these, all the different ways that sentient beings have as their body, it doesn't work. Is as a human being that we have everything that we need. Whether the tenets come into it or not depends on the commentary. So, for instance, the commentary that we used on Tantric Grounds and Paths, the Cherkey Nyima Gyaltsen, I think that's the name, I often get around the wrong way, he was a proponent of the middle way autonomy school. So it has mind-only tendencies. But that's okay. So the tenets don't necessarily fit perfectly into the middle way, but that mind-only school or tendencies, mind-only school tendencies, is very useful for tantric practice. So, again, there's no inherits in there, Ben. So then we have the chakras. energy wheels or knots. So there where the channels twist around the center. And like I said before, they're either depicted what's actually there or what we're trying to achieve. And there are five main ones: crown, throat, heart, navel, and secret place, or the base of the spine. So our job in meditation is to try and loosen those knots so that the energy can enter into the central channel. The winds can enter into the central channel. Then we have the winds, vital life force. You could call it chi, you could call it prana, but it's the movement, the energy that moves through the channels. So we have the coarse winds breathing in and out. Then we have the subtle winds, and often when they're out of kilter, that's when we're clumsy, when we fall over easily, when our health gets disrupted. If you've done Tai Chi, you can definitely feel that energy. I think there's even, you know, party tricks where you just hold your hand like this until you can feel a glowing ball, and you throw it at someone or something and you can actually begin to feel it. And when you do the mudras in the, in puja or the meditation, you can feel that energy. It's actually physically working with that level of energy. And that's why when you start off doing mudras, they're all boxy and clunky, because our energy is, it's natural. And then as you start harnessing that energy, then they start having a natural flow because the energy starts flowing. So it's something you can't force. And then the drops, the coalescing of mind and wind. In certain areas of the body, into very subtle drops. So these subtle drops are physical, but they're on a very subtle level. Just like air or wind, it's physical, but it's a subtle level. You can't see it. You can only kind of see it indirectly when something else moves, or you can feel it. And so there are more grosser ones, more subtle ones, and then what's called the indestructible drop at the heart, the subtle basis of our body, comes from the red and white drops from the mother and the father. And I have some things to read you about this from Foundation of Buddhist Thought, the English Geshe Thachi Serin, because he really puts things clearly. So he's talking about the practice of cleansing the channels, which is the meditation that we did to start tonight. We can do this practice called cleansing the channels that helps to activate the central channel and protects our mind from possible harm during the practice. The practice starts with the 9-round breathing meditation, but here we actually manipulate the winds, making it very powerful. We visualize the 3 main channels, with the left and right channel entering the central channel, 4 finger widths below the navel. As we do the 9-round breathing meditation, we actually feel each channel being cleansed. And if we're doing completion stage meditation, this is no longer imagination. We actually do this. Although cleansing the channels is not a difficult practice, I must give a big warning here that applies to this practice and all practices that follow it. If you do this without proper preparation, which means thorough grounding in the graduated path, and without a stable deity practice, you will lose your mind. I mean that quite literally. You really need to know what you're doing. Otherwise, all sorts of things can start to happen. If the energies move into a wrong area, moving them back again is incredibly difficult. There are many meditators who've gone completely crazy because they've not followed the practices correctly or they've tried to take shortcuts. So this I know from various friends that have had an experience of doing a chakra cleansing or a meditation or something, and they've been really impressed because they felt something. And so then they've gone and experimented, just like you experiment with LSD or drugs or whatever. And so if you experiment, oh, wow, what if I imagine the wind going here or doing this? Or what if I imagine I had wings or whatever, and you actually move that energy somewhere else? Then, like you said, it's very hard to move it back again. Just like if you've taken too much LSD, it's very hard to get grounded again. So this is like, because we are actually working with very sensitive machinery, we've got to be very sensitive about it, just like with chemistry. And if we just kind of do chakra meditations to feel nice or for fun, which is pretty much in the West what people do, because that's what they want, that's their motivation, is some form of like inner entertainment instead of the external entertainment, then you can actually activate a lot of these energies. And then in the end, it's like trying to kind of use one of those floor sanders, you know, just go, whoa, because you're actually mucking around with actual energy. So then he goes on to say, with the drops, okay, so the indestructible drop at the heart, the origin of all the drops, itself originates from the father's white drop and the mother's red one, and is the basis for our physical body. We talk of the indestructible drop as one entity, but in fact it consists of two elements. Generally, when we say the indestructible drop, we mean the indestructible drop of this life, which is a very subtle material object that is destroyed at the end of our life. It's the size of a small pea, white at the top and red below, almost like a small spherical container of two parts. It can be split in two at death, allowing the eternal indestructible drop, the very subtle wind and mind, to be released. The very subtle consciousness and its wind that leave the body at the time of death is called the eternal indestructible drop. It carries through to the bardo, and it enters the womb of the mother at conception. It's called eternal because of the continuation that's always there, not because it's unchanging. The very subtle fundamental wind and the consciousness rides and wind the consciousness rides on is the permanent body we looked at above. In a sense, the indestructible drop is the container, and the mind and wind inside are the contents. Mind and wind depend on each other. Without mind, there can be no wind, and without wind, there can be no mind. And it's the container of the indestructible drop that holds them together. So this is really subtle anatomy, and it's something that our Western science has no idea about. And often when we first come across it, we might think, oh, yeah, it's just some kind of quaint made-up thing. But even our Western science is still discovering things about our body. It's not like it's a done deal. So I remember in one of the Bendigo retreats, and I think it might have even been in 2016, that Western science discovered a whole new organ in the body that covers 80% of our body. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
Isn't great? So this, it's an organ, it's called the interstitial fluid. So it is an actual organ in our body, but you can't see evidence of it unless it's working. And so if you're studying a cadaver, you can't see it. But what it is is how the interstitial fluid on this layer of our skin moves. The fluid moves in and out of this layer. And this is an actual organ in our body that keeps us alive. And they only discovered it like 5 years ago. And then when you think about it, you can actually feel it. Because, you know, when you get quite dehydrated or quite tired and you get that zingy feeling, that's because your interstitial fluid is being sucked out of that organ. And so the energy is being depleted in your body. So once you hear about it, you can go, ah, that's that. But until then, we didn't even know. So that's a fairly physical, fairly subtle physical experience, and yet that's still on the coarse body level. So of course our Western science hasn't come across this psychic anatomy lesson. Interstitial fluid. I love it because it explains so much, because I've always felt it and I've just tried to explain it to people. And then finally I was reading just this tiny little bit of a news clip down the bottom. I went, there it is. Fantastic. Okay. So the path of highest yoga tantra takes this machinery, amazing machinery within the body, and it's divided into two stages. One's called generation stage and one is called completion stage. So generation stage is like the meditations, like being in a flight simulator. When you're going to learn to ride the rocket ship of tantra, you don't just go, oh, there's a nice rocket, I think I'll get in and see what happens, woohoo. No, you just, like as a pilot, you've got to do how many hours of flight simulation before you're even allowed near the rocket ship. So generation stage is doing the meditations in imagination, but they're very specific. And they are meditations that are called taking the three kayas onto the path. So they're similar to the natural process of death, intermediate state, and rebirth. So it's a rehearsal. Just like when we did that meditation just before, it's a bit of a rehearsal. And maybe as we do the meditation more, we'll get to actually feel the energy. And the first time I kind of start to feel the energy was because I felt one side's always stronger than the other side. You know, one side's always really weak because my energy is all discombobulated. So you become aware of that. Or one side you can see it and concentrate really easily, and the other side is just not there. So you're slowly becoming aware of that subtle level. So in generation stage, you're doing this rehearsal in imagination, the flight simulator, again and again and again and again. Completion stage is through that same meditation, you actually gain control of all those subtle winds in the body that flow along all of those channels, and you bring them into the central channel. And when you do that, then you can separate your subtle body and mind from your coarse body and mind. And you attain what's called the illusory body or the rainbow body, the body made of light, arising into the form of the deity. And you can do this actually in meditation without dying. No. Generation stage, this is more like there's... If you're doing a meditation, there'd still be preliminary practices, the main body of the practice, and concluding rites. That's with everything. This is more like in lower tantras, you have yoga with signs and yoga without signs, and those various stages of the path of action tantra. So this is the path of high yoga tantra, generation stage and completion stage, two stages in it. And the meditations that you do are taking the three kayas onto the path, which we're going to get to in a moment. So the structure is quite different. What the meditations are on is quite different, much more specific. And whereas you'd probably think in action tantra, it mostly looks like it's generation stage, not completion stage. It looks like it's mostly happening in the mind because you're not actually focusing on that physical body of the psychic anatomy. Whereas in this, you're now looking much more specifically at the psychic anatomy. And that's why then it can end up being completion stage, actually doing it. Here is a little bit about taking the three kayas onto the path through the process, similar to death, intermediate stage, and rebirth. Let's see. We generally think that dying is something negative, but this is just our projection. In fact, dying can be a lot better than the experiences we ordinarily think of as pleasurable, because these ordinary experiences cannot give us tremendous bliss and peace. A beautiful flower can give us something, but not the extraordinary bliss and peace that the death experience can. A boyfriend or girlfriend may be able to give us a certain amount of pleasure or bliss, but cannot solve any of our fundamental problems. They can give only a temporary solution to some of our more superficial emotional problems. But at the time of death, all of our emotional problems and all our anxiety end, as all the conflicting concepts of this and that naturally disappear into space. The way is open to experience extraordinary penetrative insight. So what we have to realize is that death is not a sudden and terrifying annihilation, but a gradual process during which our mind grows more and more fine and subtle. If we want to practice highest yoga tantra, or even if we merely want to prepare for what we must all eventually encounter, we should become as familiar with this gradual process as we can now. Because if we wait until the moment of death itself, it will be too late. For the person who's well prepared, the dying process offers an unequaled opportunity to experience what he or she has always been searching for, the subtle, penetrating, and supremely blissful mind of clear light. However, although such a blissful mind arises automatically during the death process, most of us are unable to take any advantage of it at all. Our death, like our life, goes by without conscious, clear-minded control. And what could have been the gateway to liberation becomes instead a passage into yet another lifetime of confusion. The cure for such uncontrollably recurring confusion is a type of meditation in which we transform our ordinary experiences of death, birth, and rebirth into the enlightened experience of a Buddha. So that's specifically what the path of Hisoka Tantra does. So how we can go through these three kayas, we look at what's called the basis, the path, and the result. So the basis is like just our ordinary us, our life, ordinary death, the gradual process of our body shutting down, going through the eight stages of the death process, where the body loses its ability to support the mind. We have the coarse consciousnesses dissolve. We have what are called the 80 indicative conceptions dissolve. Then we have the four subtle appearances. And then right at the end of the death process, that's when the extremely subtle body and mind become manifest, only when all those more coarse ones have dissolved. So, of course, what happens at the time of the basis is we don't notice it. It's too subtle. We just kind of zoom on through to another rebirth. So on the time of the path, what we do is we meditate on the death process and that the stages of dissolution. And when we get to that part where the subtle energies enter the central channel, all of the coarse levels have dissolved, you arrest ordinary appearances and conceptions and focus on emptiness, meditate on emptiness. So it's doing it in practice of going through that process of all of the extraneous distractions dissolving and the mind becoming very subtle, the clear light mind, and then meditating on emptiness. And so how you can actually do this is by drawing those winds into the central channel. That central channel is unblocked. All of those constrictions and tight things of the chakras are unblocked. The winds enter into the central channel. And then your mind's completely undistracted, completely clear, completely blissful, and then you meditate on emptiness. So So at the time of the result, what happens? The clear light dawns. You attain the Dharmakaya. So it's taking this natural process of death, harnessing it to get the result, the Dharmakaya. So then, just like we talked about, the Dharmakaya is enough from our side, but what about sentient beings? So then the next one, because we're going through the three kayas, the three bodies, Sambhogakaya. So at the time of the basis, the ordinary intermediate state. So when we die, we leave our old body behind, we rise into the intermediate state. So it's a more subtle body and mind, and usually the form that we arise into reflects our future rebirth. So this is a natural process, and we harness that. So at the time of the path, through meditation. So instead of arising through the power of confusion and affliction and attachment and all of these things, you arise through the power of what's propelling you, your aspirational prayers, your good-heartedness, your altruistic motivation. So you are propelled by the momentum of bodhicitta. So from the emptiness, you spontaneously arise through the power of bodhicitta into a subtle body. And so instead of the subtle body of your future rebirth as a cat or a crocodile, it's the subtle body of your future rebirth as a deity, as a Buddha. At the time of the result, that means you actually arise into the Sambhogakaya. And then, just like I'll never forget you saying, Ben, then you need to arise into something more for sentient beings, something, a humanoid form. So then we take rebirth. So the seed syllable, that's the seed for the rebirth. Rebirth and Nirmanakaya. So at the time of the basis, normally we take rebirth under the power. We're pushed around by karma and affliction. You know, we are attracted to our future rebirth like iron filings attracted to a magnet. There's just, you know, no control over it. Well, we get it at the time of uncontrolled death or at the time of taking it onto the path? If we pass away tonight, we'll go through the dissolution process and the clear light mind will arise. And then if we're not used to being still, we'll just travel on right through it. But if we're used to being still, to stilling the mind, we have a chance to stay in that clear light state where all distractions are gone and we can then meditate on something worthwhile, the nature of reality. And burn up all of our delusions, because it's like a nuclear power station mind. It's so powerful because there's no distractions. There's no tiredness. There's no conception. There's no trauma hampering us. There's nothing. It's just this powerful, clear mind. But if we haven't practiced being still, we'll miss it. If we haven't practiced containing our mind and focusing our mind, we'll miss it. So then arising out of that, there is a movement. So what normally moves us into the intermediate state, we're just propelled by our habits, our hopes, our fears, our yearnings, our confusions, you know. And that's what causes us to move into the intermediate state. So what we have to get really familiar with is what moves us is bodhicitta. That's our momentum, deeply, instinctually our momentum. So it depends, you know, when you think about, well, what seed is ripening, we've got to have a meritorious seed ripening on our mind, because if we get on the wrong plane, there's no getting off. Once you're on the plane, you're on the plane. So we have to have a positive, virtuous mind. No, you are the Dhammakaya and you arise into the seed syllable, the Sambhogakaya. I mean, we kind of have an idea of this when we go to sleep, where our coarse consciousnesses dissolve a bit. That's why we can sleep. And then we arise into a sleep body, you know, and then we're pushed around hither and thither. So then when we take rebirth, so instead of taking rebirth under the power of karma and affliction, what causes us to take rebirth is this momentum of bodhicitta. And the type of body that we're arising into is the fully fledged body of a Buddha, of a deity. At the time of meditation, what you're doing first in imagination is arising in imagination as the body of that deity, Chenrezig or Yamantaka or Vajigini or whoever. The whole purpose is to be able to accomplish the well-being of others. That's why you do it. And so then which form you arise into depends on how you're going to help sentient beings. That's why there's myriads of forms, because sentient beings need help in myriads of ways. At the time of meditation, then as one's doing that again and again and again, then one can actually arise as a body of light whilst your coarse body is sitting there meditating. And you can go and do the work for sentient beings as a body of light, so that the connection between body and mind isn't severed. It's not happening at death time. And you know, you're not actually leaving your body and being reborn somewhere. What you're doing is separating out the subtle body and mind from the coarse. And then at the time of the result, you actually achieve the rainbow body, spontaneously manifest in whatever form suits sentient beings. So the meditations at the time of the path, they're very specific, and they you have the initiation, you have the sadhana. The sadhana walks you through all of the processes and the visualization, and then that visualization becomes reality. So the structure is quite particular, isn't it? High Soka Tantra structure is always like this, taking the three kayas onto the path. And what's fantastic is that, you know, you practice this in life. You don't have to just wait till you're one shot when you're dying. You do all the practicing first. Kind of there's a correlation between those three levels of the coarse body, the subtle body, and the very subtle. But this one, taking the three kais onto the path, shows the process. And the process is reflected in the sadhana, in the meditation. So on completion stage, you know, all of that is first off, with the sadhana, you start as a rehearsal. Then completion stage, you actually transform your ordinary body into an enlightened being. So it's, you go from the flight simulator to actually getting in the rocket ship and going. So there is in your notes, if you've got the notes, there's a completion stage chart. It's chart 15. And the tricky thing about this chart is you've got to read it from the bottom upwards. Then it makes sense. And where are we? Something else to read from Lama Yeshe. No, from the bottom upwards. You read from the bottom up because it's a progression, starting from the beginner up to the top. So Lama Yeshe says the generation stage practice of the three kayas is in fact only a rehearsal for the more advanced completion stage practices that actually transform our ordinary body and mind into the completely transcendent body and mind of an enlightened being. But the generation stage preparation is absolutely necessary. It's only through loosening the concrete concepts that we have about ourselves, by generating the clear appearance of the deity out of the space of emptiness and cultivating strong divine pride that we are the actual deity, that we can create the room needed for transformation to take place. Once we are skilled enough to engage in the completion stage practices, we'll be able to bring all of our energy winds into the central channel and cause them to dissolve into it completely as they do at death. As a result, the clear light wisdom of our fundamental mind will actually dawn. And eventually we will be able to manifest the rainbow-like illusory body, which can leave and return to our old physical body at will. These things actually happen. They're not mere visualizations anymore, as they were during generation stage. The precious Kundalini energy that is dormant within us is actually aroused. We attain the simultaneously born great blissful wisdom, and we overcome the limitations of our ordinary physical form. Starting with single-pointed concentration. So single-pointed concentration, visualizing the deity, the mandala, the whole, everything, and being able to see it perfectly in your mind, travel around through it, have a look at every single detail and be able to hold that visualization for up to 4 hours without wavering. And then for as long as one wants, for a month or a year or 2 years. So single-pointed concentration, really powerful, so that there's no distractions. Then you engage in what's called Vajra recitation to halt all of the coarse conceptions and the coarse winds. So the particular recitations of the mantra with the visualization. And Vajra recitation then causes all those winds to enter into the central channel, to abide there, and then to dissolve into the heart. When this happens, it causes that clear light to dawn that normally only dawns at the time of death. Then one progressively meditates on emptiness, and as a result, one can arise into the what's called impure illusory body, then into the pure illusory body, and then so on until enlightenment dawns. So this might be a continuous process that takes many months or many years until we attain the union of illusory body and clear light mind. So this is where my favorite story comes in. Some of you already remember this story, because we might be thinking, oh, no way, but actually, if you talked before people landed on the moon, everyone said, oh, no way. Or if someone said, hey, you could have this little square in your hand and look up anything about the world, you'd go, oh, no way. So the ultimate fruition of the practice is the attainment of the rainbow body, a body of pure energy. When a realized practitioner is about to die, his or her physical body gradually dissolves into light, especially this is talking about realized Dzogchen practitioners. In such cases, the physical body actually vanishes, shrinking in size until only the hair and nails remain as indicators of the process that's occurred. Each element of the body, earth, water, fire, air, space, dissolves into the corresponding energy from which it originally arose. The attainment of the rainbow body means that the person has moved from the physical or Nirmanakaya realm of existence to the Sambhogakaya, in which there is the appearance of energy light and form, but no physical matter. Having attained this, one no longer undergoes the process of death and rebirth. This attainment of the rainbow body is typically accompanied by strange phenomena of lights and rainbows, marking the non-physical state into which the practitioner is moving. So this happens often when great practitioners are dying. There'll be rainbows manifesting right over the house where they are. So there's this great story in contemporary times. Tulku Ergin tells that there was a person took the rainbow body in a cow shed of one of my guru's household. An elderly nun came through their village on pilgrimage. When she saw the wealthy household, she asked for a place where she could make a short retreat. So they offered her one of their vacant cow sheds because, you know, she's just an old lady and just a nun. And she told them, "I want to use it for a week to make a strict retreat. I want the door sealed up. Please pile stones against the door because I don't want any disturbances." Since they were used to sponsoring practitioners, they agreed and no one thought twice about it. They said, "Sure, have it your way." They didn't know who was going to look after her or bring her food. They just thought she'd already made arrangements. After 3 days, some strange phenomena began to occur. Scintillating, swirling light rays of different colours were seeping out of the holes and cracks of the cowshed stone wall. Light was shining out from under the room, and while outside the shed, spheres of light moved rapidly about. The people of the house wondered, "What's going on here? Who's looking after the old woman and who's bringing her food?" They asked their servants. The servants thought someone else was giving her food, but no one actually was. They decided she must have been cooking for herself. But there wasn't any place to cook inside. "What's she eating? Does she have any water? What are all those lights about?" So finally they decided to have a look. They removed the pile of stones and pried open the door. They saw that the body of the nun had fallen to pieces. Her hands were lying in one place and her feet were lying in another. Her limbs were no longer connected to the body but lay scattered in pieces. And from the ends of the bones, swirls of rainbow light were crawling out as the body continued to fall apart. The observers asked each other, "Oh, what's this? Looks like she's dead." And one person had the presence of mind to say, "Oh, let's leave her alone. It looks like something unusual is happening here. She asked for 7 days of solitude, so let's just do what she asked." And saying that, they sealed the shed up again. When they returned after the 7th day and opened the shed, the rainbow lights had vanished. Not a drop of blood, nor flesh, nor bones could be found anywhere. Only the nails from the fingers and toes remained lying there very neatly, along with a hank of hair. So that's just one story, but there's many stories like that. So at completion stage, this actually happens. It's not just an analogy or a figment anymore. And when you think about it, our body is made up of atoms and chemical compounds, how many, 4 billion years old from the time at the beginning of the universe, it naturally dissolves back to those elements. So how's this done exactly? Well, the amazing thing is, with our body-mind complex, we have everything that we need right here. And while we're in our samsaric realm, our fuel for samsara is desire and confusion, and we end up in samsara. But we can use this fuel that arises from desire within our body to propel us, to focus our mind, to really harness it. So there's a couple of things. One thing, follow the instructions. Don't be like Beaker, because it is really like working in a chemical lab, right? And whether you understand what happens when you put chemicals together or not, doesn't matter. If you put them together, you're going to get the reaction. So with highest yoga tantra practice that works specifically with chemicals in the chemical lab of your subtle body, if you manipulate them, you will get a result. So you really want to follow the instructions. You don't want to blow up like Beaker did every night. So the instructions are in the Sadhana practice, in the commentaries, from the guru's advice, oral tradition, and of course grounded in the three principal aspects of the path. And then you can't go wrong. You might think that is really obvious, but there are countless people and Westerners in particular that just think they'll just go and experiment and do their own thing and really get into serious trouble and do go nuts and then make it all over YouTube and the interwebs and whatever, because everybody loves a scandal. So we've got to have the appropriate initiation, and that also means that we need all the checks and balances in initiation, holding the vows, keeping the vows really purely. Then we can't get into trouble. Then we'll be fine. So I really like this. It's worth remembering that the chemical reaction will occur whether we're ready or not, whether we understand it or not. It's going to happen if we do the work. I had a little analogy here. I think we've just got time to do it. Of the how the generation stage and the completion stage work together, and why it's so important to do everything in imagination first and get it all right in your mind, because it's a lot more than just play acting or just imagination. So this is from Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself, and it's just a little story about an experiment that is as hard to believe as it is simple. So these two doctors, Yu and Cole, showed that imagining that one is using one's muscles actually strengthens them. So the study looked at two groups, one that did physical exercise and one that imagined doing exercise. Both groups exercised a finger muscle Monday through Friday for 4 weeks, so not that long. The physical group did trials of 15 contractions with a 20-second rest between each, and the mental group merely imagined doing 15 contractions with a 20-second rest between each, while also imagining a voice shouting at them, harder, harder, harder. Okay, so at the end of the day, at the end of the study, the subjects who'd done the physical exercise increased their muscular strength by 30%, as one might expect. So it's just from a short amount of time. And those who only imagined doing the exercise for the same period increased their muscle strength by 22%. The explanation lies in the motor neurons of the brain that program movements. During these imaginary contractions, the neurons responsible for stringing together sequences of instructions for movements are activated and strengthened, resulting in increased strength when the muscles are contracted. So when we do our meditations, especially meditations of harnessing this process of death and arising into the intermediate state and then being propelled into a rebirth, and we practice that over and over with this motivation of bodhicitta and arise as the deity, where we're working all of those supportive muscles. So when death time comes, bam, we'll do it. No, well, the Zen stories of being hit over the head and then having a realization of becoming enlightened, they take that story without the huge picture. So the big picture is everything has to be lined up for that to happen. You have to have the seed of it. You have to have the environment. You have to have the merit. So a whole lot of a Zen practitioner's life is that ordinary bit beforehand where you're doing all of that. But then the actual experience is completely different. The actual experience, and often it is a whack over the head. Why? Because there's a physical component of shocking your nervous system that opens it up so that you have a chance then for the mind to also have a realization. But it's not in a vacuum. Yeah. So in many people who take drugs might have a taste of this.
I'm talking specifically about LSD.
Yeah, LSD in particular. So that gives you a bit of a general taste of seeing reality on a different level. But if you have no purpose for it, and you don't know how to integrate that into your life, or even what it means, or even how it demonstrates dependent arising and emptiness, if you've got none of that, you can't use the experience. However, going through an experience affects us, doesn't it? But what we do, we take a very materialistic view of that and go, I know, more experience, have more, so we consume it.
Analogy I've had on it.
Yeah, that's right. You've climbed to the top of the ladder. The ladder gets knocked out from under you. But why? Because if you're relying on an external experience like drugs to have, or like LSD to have this experience, it's attention capture. It's not you focusing. You're not in control of it. And that's why the, you know, LSD trips can go very wrong as well as very right. So this is a real difference between our mind being drawn outwards for hours with video games and drugs and whatever. It's attention capture. There's no training in there, and we're not actually harnessing what's happening, even though we might be really moved and impressed. But you can't even catch that experience, and you certainly can't manifest that again. It's gone until you have the drugs again. Whereas this is actually like manufacturing that oneself from the power of concentration, propelled by bodhicitta, so you can manufacture it again and again and you control it. So it's really different. Yeah, so I mean, at least with drugs, you get some kind of an idea, oh, yeah, there's an alternate reality. And that's important to know that. But you only have to know that once. You don't have to know that like 60 times in a row. But see, that is the thing, that having a taste or an experience like that, why it is so important, and that's why we have an initiation, so that you have a taste or an experience of the whole process. And it's as intense, more so intense, than a sexual experience or an LSD experience. And just like that experience of it then can carry you through your whole life for the next 20 years, it can inform your whole life and how you look at the world. That's what the initiation is about. And so initiation from a really qualified master is like that. Oh, okay. And then the last bit, oh my God, we've gone really over, but I have to talk about this, have to address this. So there's, of course, lots of misconceptions about taking a consort, especially when it comes to highest yoga tantra, because you see images of sexuality and you think it's about sexuality, but it's not. In fact, it's not even gendered, because you can be, whether you're a man or a woman, you're still doing these same meditation practices. At some stage, you do have to take a consort to be able to actually generate a sense of bliss in the body physically. But whether it's a physical consort or whether it's what's called like a wisdom consort in imagination, either will do. So to the time that you take a consort, you must have reached completion stage. So anyone that's like, oh great, let's go and do high yoga tantra, it means we can use all of our sex on the path. No, that's not what it's about. You actually have to reach completion stage, and you probably only do it once. It's not like a daily activity. It's just once, so that you get a taste of it, that you have it activated. Very similar to like a drug experience. It's just, you just need the once to have that sense, that experience. So first you have to learn to ride the horse. First you have to learn to harness your concentration and your energy to have completely generated renunciation. Then you can put the ballerina on top. Not before. And if you're a monk or a nun, then you take a wisdom consort, not a human one. And if you take a human one, you must give your robes back. You renounce your vows, you become a layperson, and then you can. So there's been a lot of confusion in the West and also in Tibet about this, of people breaking vows left, right, and center. No, there's no ambiguity here. So Lama Yeshe says, when the completion stage practices have been mastered and we've gained control over our subtle energy winds, there will come a time when the Dharkas and the Dharkinis will come. Who are they? Simply speaking, they are males and females who possess advanced experiences of tantric transformation and control and are thereby able to increase the blissful wisdom of a highly qualified practitioner. There's a certain point in the mastery of the completion stage when physically embracing such a consort is necessary for bringing all the pervading energy winds into the central channel, a prerequisite for opening the heart center completely and experiencing the profoundest level of clear light. This subject of practice with a consort is open to great misinterpretation, especially by people who've made only superficial contact with Buddhist Tantra. Many Westerners, for instance, think that because they've seen Tibetan paintings and statues showing deities in embrace, they have the mistaken notion that Tibetan Buddhism is mainly concerned with sexual contact between men and women. But actually, the art is representing the experience of totality, of method and wisdom, bliss and emptiness, the characteristic of the fully enlightened state. All right, so... Highest Yoga Tantra, highly specialized guidebook. It's the treasure map. The psychic anatomy, a very comprehensive system to fully utilize this body-mind complex. So instead of our samsaric body being the basis for more confusion, more samsara, it's the basis for nirvana. Through meditation, practicing again and again and again, eventually we can actually arise into the rainbow body of a Buddha. And plan B, at least if we can't arise into the rainbow body of a Buddha now, at least at the time of our death, we'll be so practiced that it'll just come naturally. Well, we could be a plan C is being reborn into a pure land. So Geshe Zopa said, you just arise as the deity. And whenever you see light, so actually when you go to sleep, you sleep in the Dharmakaya. And when you arise as the deity. And whenever you see light, you think, oh, here I am in the pure land. And you could just do that every night. So much, much better to take a shortcut to the pure land to finish the practice and then come back to help sentient beings. So reading Highest Yoga Tantra section is pages 5 to 7. There's some words of advice from Geshe Temple. If you got the hard copy book, it was after the mind maps. It's just a little page. So we'll talk about that in a fortnight because in a fortnight's time we'll talk about how to set up a retreat, do some concerted practice, and the keys to success in Tantra, how to make sure that we have success. So I'm sorry, we've gone, go like 5 minutes over each time. So next week, remember, Buddha's birthday, really big day. Let's make lots and lots of merit because that's going to be the deciding factor, isn't it? We need merit. And, of course, we'll have lots of special dedications for the world and for COVID and the climate. I'm not sure. I have to think about it. So let's dedicate. Thank you so much for your attention. And let's think that, really recognize our extraordinary, perfect human rebirth and what we have, this treasure that we have that we don't even know, and dedicate, may we bring this to fruition, may we use this treasure, this one shot at it, to help ourselves and every single living being in the very best possible way. And that may we have an opportunity to enter the path of high Soga Tantra and practice like this and actually arise as a Buddha for the benefit of all in this very lifetime. So thank you very much for your attention. Online people, just give me a minute. Anthea had a question here. After the person does the rainbow death thing, do you take another rebirth? So at the time of the path, when we're meditating, we meditate again and again and again and again, and you arise as the deity again and again and again until it becomes second nature. At generation stage, and then at completion stage, you actually start arising as the deity, as the rainbow body. And then that rainbow body becomes clearer and more powerful, and then you can arise as many rainbow bodies, 10, 20, thousands. So then if you take another rebirth, it's no longer uncontrolled rebirth, it's controlled. So you can arise as the rainbow body, but you can also take a rebirth as a human being on purpose, choose your mother and father through the power of, you know, through your motivated by bodhicitta, and actually be reborn as a human being as well, if you want, but it's no longer uncontrolled, pushed willy-nilly.
Going back to the nine-round breathing, I dimly remember in the past being suggested to, you know, just hold the nostril while we were doing it, just to sort of get used to the idea of it, you know, because...
Yeah, so if you're holding the nostril, I mean, there's a couple of... It can be, but if you're going to hold the nostril, have a look at the video of His Holiness the Dalai Lama doing the nine-round breathing, because it's not just holding the nostril. You actually put one hand under your armpit and you block some of the channels there, and then you hold the nostril with the other hand and you're blocking that channel. So as you're blocking the channels, then you're also blocking the particular disturbing minds that flow on those channels. So there's a particular way to do it. It's not just like sticking your finger on your nose. It's beautiful how he does it. I'm sure if you just Googled on, just search YouTube, you'll find it. It's His Holiness giving a teaching. It might be even translated like from French or something like that. I'm not sure, but you'll find it.
I was reading a bit of the Tantra book by Tashi Sering, the English one, and it was sort of talking about the cessation of wanting to be, starting with attachment, you know, sort of thing. But he said the bodhisattvas, they had to have a certain small amount of attachment left over to want to come back and sort of take birth as a human being to benefit all sentient beings. So how much is enough attachment?
So how much is enough attachment? Probably it's to do with the definition of attachment. So attachment generally just means having an exaggerated opinion of things, overestimating things. So it's distorted and out of whack. Whereas this, if you're saying you need a bit of attachment to come back to help sentient beings, what you're more saying is it's to have that impetus to help sentient beings. And how you take a rebirth as a human being ordinarily on a kind of ordinary level, you see your parents having sex, you have desire arising towards one and dislike towards the other, and then that propels you into where the sperm and the egg meet, into the mother's womb, and it kind of determines then which sex you are, which gender you are. So that's normally out of the under the power of you know, being thrown around by our karma and our delusion and our merit to find a good rebirth. So to actually be able to then enter into a good rebirth, you have to have some kind of momentum that propels you there. But it's not motivated by afflictive states of mind or delusion or hatred or anything like that. As a bodhisattva person, you know, taking rebirth on purpose.
You know, if you're going down that bodhisattva path, you know, if you're going to sort of remain until the end of cyclic existence to benefit all beings, you know, you have to keep.
Like, so not all desires are bad. The desire to help others, the desire to do things well, the desire to be kind, to study well, all of those things, they're not necessarily afflicted. So there's kind of a difference between the desire to do something and then desirous attachment. The attachment is the bit where the affliction is in there. Then again, when we're reading things in the English, depending on what translation and things, you've got to really get the context right. What's attachment? What's desire? What do they actually mean?
So I just wanted to check with the 9-round breathing. I heard of a variation where, when you breathe in from the left side into the left channel, you breathe in the enlightened mind of the Buddhas, and then breathe out to the right, you let go of all the attachment energy. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So you can get more specific. And so one channel is more to do with attachment energy and the other channel is more to do with hatred energy. And so then you can go more specifically about which particular delusions that you're clearing out. And on that picture, you would have seen one was kind of red and one was blue to reflect those. So again, that's a generic way of talking about it. But Geshe Zopa said, actually, then depending on what gender you are, the left and the right channels swap over. So what is the left channel for women is the right channel for men. So again, you have the generic overall diagram, but in actual practice, it's just like physical anatomy. You have the diagram, but everybody's anatomy is quite different.
Okay. So which side is which?
So what you do is the practice that you get from your lama.
Oh gosh.
You know, or the practice that you get from the meditation that you're doing in your meditation class, or the way that the practice is described at the beginning of the sadhana practice. Have a lineage and you have instructions from the teacher.
I just got a generic one from, I think, Venerable Rubina. It wasn't part of a sadhana or anything.
Yeah, so then you just use, she'll have a legit one and hers will have come from Lama Zorro Rinpoche, so you just go with that, with those instructions.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So and again, it's not that, things are right or wrong. There are just many, many different ways to do this because there are many variations. And depending on how subtle that you get. And like I was saying about the chakras, sometimes they're drawn as the result. Sometimes they're drawn as, you know, all tangled. And sometimes the chakras are different colors and in totally different places because it's a different system. Yeah. So you just have to know what system you're using and then be consistent with it.
So like you were saying earlier, that you could sort of feel that you're kind of out of whack, that you're stronger in one than the other. So if we know that our main delusion is, for example, attachment, so one would be the weaker side, I guess?
No, that one would be the stronger one.
Okay. <All right. laughs>
And so, I mean, that's what's so good about this breathing meditation is it balances them. It clears the channels and it balances them because you do one, the other, and then the middle. And then if you're still not balanced, you do the process again.
Oh, okay. And then as long as we just stick to the instructions that we're given.
Yeah, yeah. And then over time, you'll notice sometimes your energy is strong, sometimes it's weak, sometimes one side's strong, sometimes the other, and you'll get to know yourself. Just like you get to know yourself when you're trying to get fit for instance.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, good. okay, so Anthony's saying, is a way to start to train my mind for being useful at death time to learn how to do the conscious dreaming. So, yes, there are books at Langri Tampa Centre about conscious dreaming, and one, Sleeping, Dreaming, Dying, or something like that. If you search our library catalogue, you'll find a couple of them if you look up dream or sleep. And those are being able to do lucid dreaming is a very good skill, because it's that subtle body and mind, like in the intermediate state. And because dreams change in a flash, and so does the intermediate state, it's a very good practice. It also means that it's a great practice that in the dream we can go, ah, this is just a dream, and anything that's scary or whatever can just dissolve. So we don't hold so concretely to reality, because the body and the mind are much more subtle then than in our day-to-day life. So it's a really good practice ground. And it's a practice ground for not holding tightly to reality, to being able to really transform the mind and bring those practices, like trying to be patient, for instance, into your sleep, into that level that's on that instinctual level. So if you manage to have a dream and in your dream you go, oh, no, I can't do that, I'm a Buddhist, I mean, that's a really good sign. It means you've been integrating things. So it's kind of using that power. It's a very good thing to do. I mean, it's got so many benefits. Another benefit is that we stop being attached to the unconsciousness. So when we're in a dream, we're not following the allure of the fear, the allure of attachment, or the allure of being unconscious, of just ignorance and confusion. We're breaking all of those habitual I suppose they're attachments, states of mind. We're breaking all of those with the lucidity. So it's actually really controlling your mind on a very subtle level. I mean, there's things that can happen in the dream state. So you can use it for practicing, training your mind, like practicing patience, for instance, or not retaliating. So I remember at the end of one retreat that I did in my late teens, early 20s, and it was a Dorji Sempa a meditation retreat to purify. I got this real urge. Oh, my God, I have to purify all my negative karma. And at the end of the retreat, I had this dream that a monk came and smashed this Dorji into my head, like, boom. And I had this whoosh of energy, and I thought, ah, I'm going to kill you. And immediately I went, no, I'm not going to. And that was the end of the dream. I woke up, I went, beauty. But it was really intense, right? So it can give you an indication of how you're going, how your dreams are. But also when it comes to like completion stage practices, when you arise in your dream, you can actually go out and help others. You can visit others. You can help them. You can be a benefit to them. And I would say way before that, if you can practice lucid dreaming, then it's a way for your guru to communicate with you. So it's a way for His Holiness to communicate with you, or Chen Rezig to communicate with you, because you have some spaciousness and some control in your mind that then the guru and his light body can come and give you teachings and show you, you know, the way forward. And that happens to many people. But usually, you know, if we dream of our guru or something, we're just tossed around willy-nilly like a leaf in the wind, isn't it? Because we don't have much control.
When, you know, when we did, like last year, when we did the Thousand Arm Chen Rezig initiation with His Holiness, you know, there was a suggestion made to be aware of your dreams that night. What was the purpose that?
Yeah, they always do that. So with a great initiation, which goes over the two nights, you one of the instructions is you take the vows, you know, the bodhisattva vows, and then you have the special leaf or grass or something, you know, from the time of the Buddha that you put under your pillow, and then you're supposed to watch your kusha grass, and then you're supposed to watch your dreams. And then you just don't pay attention to the ones in the first half or the middle part of the night, but just to the ones just before waking up. They're the ones you pay attention to. And they're supposed to give you an indication of how you're going to go. But you know what? I've never been able to do it. So, you know, it's just one of those things. If you can do it, great. And if you can't, don't worry. But it happens at all the initiations like that, the great initiation that goes over the 2 days. And I mean, there's other things too where they might say, just open your eyes and see which color flashes to your eyes. I've never had a color flash to my eyes, you know. No, that bit never happens. So if it doesn't, don't worry, because they're such huge experience and instructions. One of them is going to land for you, not all of them, doesn't matter.
No, Rachel asked my question and you've answered it. Thanks, Miffy.
Oh, okay. About the channels.
Yeah, that male and female are different. So which one do we, which one's male, which one's female?
Yeah. So I only heard about this from Geshe Zopa and only very recently. And so, you know, I don't think you don't really have to worry, oh, I've been doing the guys one all this time, because also gender is also on a spectrum as well. There's no kind of set delineation. So I think maybe depending on what practice you're doing, sometimes for practices that are mother tantra that are specifically about bringing forth the clear light, then it might actually matter which side the channels that you're using. But for other practices that are father tantra that are both illusory body and clear light, then it wouldn't matter so much. So all of these things are often very practice oriented, as in that if you come across these very specific details, they're not just out there in the ether, they're attached to a practice. They're in a context. And so if we haven't got that practice or heard of that context, then not to worry about, just, you know, set it aside.
When it sort of says, you know, when, I mean, obviously I've done a HYT initiation, and when I'm doing the tantric vows in there, it sort of talks about performing all actions first with my left. Has that got to do with Mother Tantra, Father
Yes,
Tantra?
Yes, that's to do with Mother Tantra, yep.
Heck. Why?
Well, just like generally, the left-hand side is to do with wisdom, the feminine, and the right-hand side is to do with compassion, skillful means, the masculine. In terms of the those archetypal forces. So for Mother Tantra practice to do with mostly focused on the wisdom aspect of things, then it's to have that lead, have the left-hand side lead. So it's more like not to do everything with your left hand, but to have that attitude, leading with the wisdom, with the wisdom realizing emptiness as your starting point.
I wanted to know that for many years, but I didn't know who.
And even like I think I said a couple of weeks ago about how in this context, you know, wisdom is seen as the feminine. It's the feminine aspect. And the masculine aspect is all the different skillful means of doing things. So the worldview isn't necessarily one that we're used to. And then when you see those images of the tantric embrace, it's not that it's a sexual embrace, it's this unity of skillful means and wisdom. And whether you're a man or a woman, you do that practice. So even if you're a woman, you if you have the initiation and you self-generate in that form, in a masculine form, because we all have masculine and feminine energy within us. So, the practice is just bringing forth or harnessing different aspects of that, and everybody can do it. So actually, it is ultimately gender fluid. which is great. You know, there's no hard and fast delineation. We're using all of those energies, and we can access all of those energies, the feminine and the masculine. And whatever gender we happen to be in this life, you know, that's just a one minuscule moment. We've got this whole array, a whole spectrum within us. And so those depictions of masculine and feminine, that's what they are. It's not male and female. It's masculine and feminine energy. And we can all relate to both of those things. So I think it's almost important to call them masculine and feminine rather than male and female, because if we start saying male and female, we start thinking gendered, and we start thinking, you know, me and not me, and we start thinking on that really common level. But when we think about it as a masculine force or a feminine force, then that's something that we can all relate to. Anthea's had a 2-second lucid dream. Anthea's been in the vehicle. So she's in a car park and all the cars got backed up and came to a complete stop. And I thought, oh, how boring. I was enjoying this dream. Then I thought, oh, I'm dreaming. Okay, start moving, cars. And they did. Then I got so excited that I consciously made something happen in my dream. I started cheering and woke myself up. Excellent. Well, Anthea, you just get back in that Vajra vehicle with your fuel of bodhicitta, the momentum of bodhicitta, and off you go. And we'll be cheering. So, look, thank you so much, everybody. It's been a very long night, but I'm so pleased that you are here and that you put the time in, and I really, really rejoice. And it's just such a great adventure sharing this with you. See you later.